Timmer is a cardiac anesthesiologist at the University of Michigan. He is the Director of Quality Improvement and Quality Assurance, as well as the Aspire Quality Champion for the University of Michigan as well. And so he'll be talking to us a little bit about the University of Michigan's MPOG QI experience. So, Tim, welcome.
Hi, I'm Tim, and I do QA. I'm just testing the microphones. Good afternoon, everybody. As Nirav kindly introduced me, I'm Tim Dubovoy. I'm in charge of QA at the University of Michigan. Today, I want to give you a brief presentation. It's called Peeking Through the Keyhole, a Look at the Michigan Medicine QI. Now, the imagery of the keyhole here is not meant to represent any secrets. Trust me, there are none. Rather, I borrowed it from description of the collective consciousness given by Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre gives an example of a man who is standing in front of a closed door and he hears something interesting. He cannot resist the temptation to peek through the keyhole. He is so absorbed in the process, he's not aware of his own actions. He's not able to reflect on his behavior. But he realizes he's doing something wrong when he hears the footsteps behind him. In that sense, we as anesthesia providers very frequently find ourselves delivering suboptimal care, but we're so absorbed in the process of actual delivering of the care that we're not able to reflect on our own behavior in the moment. Oftentimes, we have to rely on an external source. It could come from the Aspire scorecard that we receive, or more frequently than not, I'm the person whose footsteps they're going to hear behind them. But in addition to giving you the overview of our program and telling you how we integrate, giving you some examples of how we integrate Aspire metrics into the QI process, I also want to bring something a bit more controversial, something that we had to deal with recently, and that's, is there a role for Aspire in the process of peer review? Now, just a word of caution, we're a large program. We have over 500 clinical providers. We're spread out across different centers, different hospitals, different ambulatory facilities, et cetera. Our QI program is also evolutionary. We don't get to start from scratch every time. Rather, we tend to build on top of the existing structures and reuse them, repurpose them, et cetera. If you see something that you like, if you like a concept, if you like the application of a tool, don't automatically assume that you need the entire model to replicate the result. Take it, use it, borrow it, make it fit your own practice. Now, these slides illustrate our historical, well-established QI process. It was built on a foundation that fosters non-punitive environment and promotes healthy culture. Those two terms have probably been overused by the QI people over time to the point that I don't even know what they mean anymore. And I certainly abused those terms many, many times, but it wasn't until recently that I actually realized that they come at a price. And there's a certain limitation built into the system that is built on those principles. Big advantages, don't get me wrong, but the limitations we often overlook and we tend to focus on the good results only. Now, within our system, we actually try to encourage our providers to report adverse events. We made it very easy for them to report them because we're actually not using the hospital reporting system. It was so cumbersome that we actually incorporated our QA reporting forms into the electronic medical record. So providers actually don't have to go out of their environment to report something is wrong. Be careful what you ask for. Right now, we actually generate over 6,000 QA reports per year. That's over 120 per week. Now, we definitely need some support staff to process all that information and to make it more digestible. So we had to learn how to drink from a fire hose, literally. Now, out of those 120 reports, once the QI staff actually reviews them, categorizes them, catalogs them, et cetera, about 20% make it to the individual reviewers. Now, individual reviewers are actually the service leads within the anesthesia department. They're assigned to particular surgical services. They take ownership. They establish content expertise. On average, each person would get about one or two reviews per week. Out of those 20 reviews per week or so, about one or two per week will make it to the QA committee for the department, which meets monthly, so we'll review probably 10 or 20 cases. And now we adjudicate whether to provide the feedback back to the individual who was involved, are any system changes warranted, or is it an educational experience that everybody can learn from? Now, this system works great, as I mentioned, but it has certain limitations. One of the biggest limitations is the subjectivity. We rely on individuals and their preferences to report an actual either adverse event or a near miss. The second limitation is the system is still reactive. Even if it's a near miss, it's still a potential event. So it fails to focus on the actual process that led to that in the first place. If you want to establish the causal relationship, you would have to do a full RCA. And those are expensive and resource intense to do properly. So they're not done often. Finally, the limitation is your interventions are really limited down to three pathways: education, constructive feedback, or system changes. We're really not equipped to handle any provider problems in this way. How does Aspire integrate into this? Well, it adds another dimension. It certainly doesn't replace the whole process. And that other dimension actually introduces additional value that removes some of the limitations of the previously described process. Number one is the methodology used for data collection. So instead of relying on individual providers to report what they think is important, the data collection is now automated and it's more objective because we are using terminology and we're using the metrics that we've all agreed beforehand. Finally, the next step is that the feedback is actually provided 100% of the time in the form of the Aspire report. So every provider knows exactly what was noted and what was done from their performance. The biggest change that we introduced was actually the meeting between the QI champion and ACQR, and this is not meant to review, to validate the failed cases. Validation of the failed cases is actually a QA requirement for submitting your Aspire data. No, this process is actually adds specificity. We're using the initial Aspire report as a screening tool, a very sensitive instrument, but it lacks specificity. It actually requires hands-on review for somebody to decide whether or not we want to proceed with the rest of the QI process. Does it actually become a QA event that will be reviewed, or are we happy with just the Aspire report given to the individual provider? And I'll give you some specific examples shortly. Now, this is one of the actual reports that we use to look at a very specific metric. This is glucose 01. This is what I look at every month with our ACQR. This report actually for the month of July. Because of the number of cases, it's completely amendable to hand review. Now, this is different from the Aspire scorecard. We had to modify that to make it more useful and to expedite the review process. You have access to the same data. Through your ACQR, through your coordinating center, you would be able to get your institution-specific data. Now, why is it important? Well, I have specific patient information that allows me to do deep dive into the anesthetic record if needed right there. I know who the providers were involved, I know where the case happened, and I know exactly or at least I try to understand what happened with the case and why it failed. So for example, if you look at the first case, they didn't start insulin, the glucose was high, they failed to check it, but they checked it 91 minutes later. They missed the metric by 1 minute. What I consider it to be a QA case. Does it warrant any further investigation? And the answer, I hope you agree, is no. It really doesn't matter. Did it fail the Aspire metric? Yes, it did. It'll still stay on the report, but it won't go beyond the actual Aspire report delivered to the provider. On the other hand, if we look at the next three cases, number two and number three involved, again, same thing. The glucose was high. We failed to recheck, and we failed to recheck for a pretty long time. The values weren't that egregious. But again, this is a significant deviation from the established protocol. So those two events will actually be treated like QA events. Service liaison will actually call the provider, follow up with them, find out exactly what happened, what can be done differently. The last one is probably even more concerning because the insulin was actually started for a blood sugar of 500, and it wasn't checked for quite some time. This is potentially will either be left to the liaison or I could get involved and find out more information. And this is one of the events that potentially could be actually referred to the QA committee as a whole and continue within that cycle. Here's another example. This is transfusion 02. Here, the columns are slightly different, but the idea is actually the same. I'm trying to get into the head of the provider and understand what was going on at that time, because what information did they have that enabled them to make that decision? If we look at the first case, we'll see that this is actually a cardiac case, and they documented the unit wrong. They documented it as a whole blood. Technically, this was actually autologous blood, and that's an appropriate practice. That actually goes back to the feedback to the coordinating center to say we potentially need to map our cases a little bit better, and also goes to providers to say, please document it appropriately. But this will not be treated as a QA event. The second one is also interesting. The final result was hematocrit of 39. There's a big gap between when the unit was actually transfused. There was a question raised by the ACQR whether additional blood was given after the patient left the operating room. The answer was yes upon further review. But notice that the transfusion threshold was 20. So the provider at the time, that's the only information they have to go by. In our place, we arbitrarily established transfusion threshold at 23. So if I see that the decision was reasonable, I don't really put as much significance if they went, for example, if the final result ended up being above 30, because really you do not have that ability to predict. You think you can model how high of a hematocrit response you're going to get from a single unit of transfusion, but certainly that may not be true in the pediatric cases. That's definitely not true in some of the adult cases. We've seen responses to hematocrit all over the place, primarily related to the volume shifts as well, not just from the immediate side of immediate effects of transfusion. So second case would not result in any QA event either. On the other hand, when you look at the last two cases, transfusion thresholds were consistently above 30 prior to initiation of the transfusion. That practice is much more concerning. Both of those events will be treated as QA events. Now notice, interestingly enough, that the last two events also tend to fail the transfusion O1 metric. So it won't be just, hey, you failed, what can you do better? It will be more specific direct feedback to say, by the way, consider following transfusion O1 parameters as well and checking the hematocrit between transfusion of the units. So much more direct, much more focused feedback for providers. Now, the way we decide what measures would be amendable to the actual hand review is, well, obviously any pay-for-performance measures that you're currently working on, any measures that are potentially QI projects that you're trying to improve throughout the year would fit that model. For example, for us, transfusion O2 was a metric that initially started out as a QI project. We locked out, it became pay-for-performance measure this year for us. And we had significant improvement using this methodology. We went from 82% to 91% this year. But really, any measure with few, and I arbitrarily say less than 15 cases, failed cases, are amendable to this process. It doesn't matter whether you have only, it doesn't matter if your performance is above 99%. If you still have failed cases that you can review, you potentially will derive significant value out of that. Right now, some of the examples that we do routinely is glucose O1, glucose O2, meta 1, tempo 3. Finally, at the request of individual providers, if somebody raises an issue, this happened just the other week, somebody called me up and said, hey, I failed my tempo 1 and all of my cases came from MPU. And we said, okay, that's interesting, let's take a look at what's going on. And it happens that during the double balloon endoscopies, which would normally be excluded because they're short cases and we historically didn't put Barrett-Hargreaves in them, all of a sudden some of the cases starting to run longer and we're failing the Aspire metric. And this is what we have to decide. Should we change the metric? Probably the wrong answer. Or should we actually change our practice and say, listen, for double balloon dust, we probably should start putting Barrett-Hargreaves on because those cases tend to run over. And historically, that didn't used to be a problem. And overall, the metric is still very good in terms of compliance. But this one provider raised it to our attention, and we need to respond. Now, this model, providers are still responsible for reviewing their own metrics. But they do it for a different reason. Provider needs to understand what happened, and they need to understand how they can change it in the future. Versus myself, the QI champion, I need to understand who the providers who were involved in the case and why did it happen. Why is important? Because, again, either the metric needs to change or our practice pattern needs to change. Who is also important? Because, for example, when we started reviewing Meadow 1, it only took 3 months to realize that three providers were responsible for over 50% of Narcan administrations. Now, that doesn't require a system change. Somehow they figured out that they might knock on part of their standard anesthetic practice, literally. But that was a very targeted feedback and very targeted intervention that actually resolved the behavior. Now, mission accomplished, right? I mean, we're very proud of our QA process. Again, long established program, et cetera. But recently, it came under scrutiny. And it came under scrutiny from the hospital administration when they said, what do you do when provider is at fault? And the response is, we're a non-punitive environment. We don't blame the providers. It's always the system. That's what we try to change. And they said, okay, nice try. What do you do with your bad providers? And we said, what do you mean? We just kick it out. It's not my problem. We don't have the tools to deal with it. I mean, this is peer review. And then they asked, well, can you tell us what your peer review process is? And we said, sure, we'll get back to you. Let us take a look at what everybody else is doing. And I tried to look for a room full of clinicians that actually works on refining the peer review process in anesthesiology, but guess what? It's not next door. I haven't seen one. Peer review does not get the attention that it deserves. And we can get into the discussion why, but it is an important topic. Last year, there was a neurosurgeon who was actually sentenced to life in prison after more than 30 cases where patients were either dead or paralyzed. And he was able to jump from hospital to hospital without generating any trail of any information that would be useful or discoverable. And this is a big concern for hospital administrators, and this should be a big concern for us as practitioners. Now, ideally, I would assume that when we kick the case out, there is some formalized peer review process, confidential discussion, case closed, etc., and it does happen. I mean, most practices have somehow adjusted to that. Now, Joint Commission does not want to use the term peer review anymore. That's dirty, because people associate it with bad perceptions, or it gets a bad rep. So technically, this particular process is called the Focused Professional Practice Evaluation, or the FPP. And to be fair, FPP has different components. I mean, you're supposed to do an FPP for new hires, you're supposed to do FPP for credentialing. But in practical terms, this is the one that people get most concerned about. And when we start looking at our practice, well, it does happen, but it's not consistent. You are at the mercy of a person who is actually doing the confidential discussion. Some people are better than others. And it's understandable that the review actually, the information is protected, needs to be kept confidential. That part is completely understandable. But it is actually not done well and not done consistently. So am I overblowing the problem? Is it really such a big issue? I mean, after all, peer review, you do FPP, you do OPP. It's interesting because read the language. Those quotes come directly from the Joint Commission. And especially the first two, I find them to be worrisome because there is an important assumption underneath. The assumption is you always have bad providers. Now, it may be true in general. Anesthesiology as a whole, that's probably true. But does it apply to every single practice? Does it make any accommodations for smaller practices? Does it? Probably not. And finally, the last quote is also very interesting because if you're not finding bad providers, that means you're not using the right metrics because guess what? You have bad providers. And unfortunately, Joint Commission is not very good about giving guidance in terms of what metrics and what parameters should be used for peer review process. And I'm not talking about just the FPP, I'm talking about OPP primarily. Periodic chart reviews, sure, we have electronic medical records right now, that's potentially amendable, but what do I look for? That's not very specific. When I look at my peer review scorecard that currently exists, I would like to think that my compliance with TB testing has something to do, probably makes me a better anesthesiologist, maybe makes me a better citizen within the hospital environment, but I doubt my patients actually benefit from it. Direct observation, well, that's prohibitive. Discussion with other individuals involved in the care of patients. This was the question that posed to us. Why don't you use surgeons to provide you feedback? We said, we would love to do that, but only if I'm able to provide feedback for them. I believe in the true 360 model, but we don't have that, unfortunately. So here's the question. Can we actually use QA and the metrics we have? Can we leverage what we have developed in our program for the peer review process? It's a dangerous question to ask because now I find myself on the other side of that keyhole. I am armed with the mandate to find bad apples, and I have a wealth of data. Will I be perceived doing something objectionable by my own providers? And I think the way around it is to actually not to get mired in the analogies, but to open the door. Let's ask ourselves, if I want to establish a true, relevant peer review process, what metrics would I choose? Well, they definitely have to be relevant to anesthetic practice. They have to be using objective criteria. That's important. We have to have a meaningful sample size. It doesn't make sense to actually do a few select chart reviews and claim that this gives us an accurate picture. They have to have high level of compliance, at least initially, because high level of compliance in this context means there's high level of acceptance. You can leverage your peers to say, yes, indeed, this is a good thing that you're doing because everybody is doing it. Now, this metric should always be a part of the OPPE. They should never in and of themselves trigger a focused professional review. That should only be triggered after the specificity added by the personal and expert review. And finally, they have to be reported frequently. Right now, the mandate for OPPE is to do it more than twice a year. Most places try to do the absolute minimum required. They would do either 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. And the frequency requirement comes from the fact that you have to give providers a chance to reflect on their behavior and improve it before it becomes an actual FPPE problem. So for us, we decided to venture into this new pathway, and we have selected these three metrics that we actually start to include on every OPP scorecard that we give to the institution. We've selected pulmonary 1, NMB2, and tempo 3 metrics. This was done after careful discussion. This was presented to the providers, and guess what? We haven't heard any significant complaints from anybody. Now, the idea that I would like to propose is really we should be integrating this process of peer review into the QI process. If we do it well, it is possible to use the same metrics that we currently have, include them into the OPP review, and hopefully actually reduce the number of the FPP events that have to happen that are actually caused a lot of anxiety and angst to our providers. This would actually introduce trust, it would introduce transparency, it would give clear ownership to the entity that actually does QI well, and hopefully we'll be able to leverage what we've learned to improve the care, because guess what? That dichotomy that currently exists between the QI and peer review, it's completely artificial. There's only one provider that's involved. And the goal of both processes, at least ideally, is the same, is to actually help decrease errors and improve patient safety. I think I'm badly out of time, but I'd like to thank Dr. Tremper for providing unwavering support for this, because without him, this would all be just on paper. Special thank you, Meredith Bailey, who is filling out as our Aspire Interim ACQR. Katie Bueller, Mike Mathis, Nirav, Sachin, thank you. No questions, I like it. Sure.
An unrelated case, they would love to come back and
no.
see how we've
so
been doing.
This is everything. If you have it defined up front, meaning if you have a document that says this is a part of our QI process, this is the documentation that we generated as a part of the QI process, it is all covered by the QI umbrella. So technically, it is not discoverable. I say technically because a judge can order full discovery and full disclosure of the documents. I am not aware of any single case where that actually happened. So as long as you define it as your process that you do, anything that fits into that process will be protected. Well, it depends how the question is phrased for credentialing, or if they ask, then yes, you would have to disclose it. Usually the questions that are being asked is, were you named in a lawsuit? Was there any claim brought against you? Things like that. This does not amount to any one of those. And technically, like I said, QI umbrella is fairly broad.
Okay, Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor.